Welcome to the IT Experience Podcast. This is a podcast for those who are interested in IT experience management in large enterprises. If you use ServiceNow or other enterprise service management system to provide services to employees, then this is for you. Brought to you by Happy Signals. More smiles, less time wasted.
Hello and welcome to the IT Experience Podcast. Darren Rose is somebody that maybe some of you have already heard and read and come across on LinkedIn and other media, as he speaks a lot about enterprise service management and service management in general. But for those who don't know you, Darren, who are you? Where do you come from?
So I'm Darren Rose. I am a service management consultant for a company based out of Reading in the UK called FSP. I've been with FSP for the sort of last 18 months. Before that, 20 years in sort of service roles, started on a service desk for a global outsourcer, and worked through sort of service management roles ever since. So didn't join with a technical background, very much customer service, and then have just kind of, gone from there and kind of followed my interests, which has led me to where I am today.
Thanks for coming on. The first time I heard you was actually on the Digital Enterprise or Enterprise Digital podcast with Barclay Ray and Ian Aitkinson, where you spoke about ESM. And I remember how practical and down to earth it was. ESM, it's been an acronym that maybe has been around more or less and maybe a little bit less and then again floating up again. And how did you get into enterprise service management? Tell your story about that.
Yeah, so it was actually at a previous place where I was working. It was for a construction company, a global construction company, but I think that also leans to why it's practical advice. So it wasn't very theoretical when working for a construction company. And it was just when there, we'd done a lot of work around, obviously, IT service management. I was the IT services director at the time. And we had, a good reputation for how we change service within the organization. And then other teams sort of naturally started to wonder if this was something they could also do. So it was really from there. And I think I'd always had an interest in enterprise service management just from I like to work how different things kind of piece together. And that's, I think, also why I'm drawn sort of ITIL and ITSM is, how processes work and how things link and kind of all map out together. And it was just really an extension of that, really. It wasn't about IT. It was just service management in general. And all of the other teams that we had within sort of business support were doing service management. They were fulfilling requests most of the time from the business. They needed something and someone was, supplying that demand and meeting that demand. And that's just service management. So for me, it just kind of seemed a natural kind of progression from ITSM to then thinking about, well, how do we do this across an organization? And the main driver for me has always been around the experience. So as an employee, can I go to one place to get everything I need? And it's kind of having that vision around just a single way of working that became the driver, and then everything else just kind of followed on from that, and enterprise service management was kind of the answer to that question.
Okay, so it's a little bit of a scratch your own itch type of situation that got you into this.
Yeah, definitely.
You've been doing this for a number of years now, and what have you seen work? Are there specific sort of principles that you have seen work over and over again that could be replicated?
Yeah, and I think I like to kind of split it in really between some of the practical things you can do. But then there is also kind of the prerequisite for some of that stuff for me is around the cultural readiness of an organization. It might be that they have aspirations to do ESM, but actually if the kind of values and beliefs of that organization aren't really in place and don't marry up with ESM, then it is kind of trying to put a square peg in a round hole. So, when I talk about things like, sort of cultural readiness, the three things that we kind of really look for around, is it collaborative as an organization? Is the user or the employee kind of central to their decision making? Is that a concept? And is there a culture of that continuous improvement? Because ESM is kind of, it's always about improving and kind of that evolution. And without those three things, then it's going to be really difficult to do. Is what we found. Don't even talk about technology at this point. It's not about solutions or tools at this point. Actually, it's really just, is there that culture of collaboration an experience understood within the organization? And is there the right leadership buy-in to actually want to change it?
So the three components that are quite different, the collaborative, you need to motivate teams to actually work together. So do you have any sort of points on like when does collaboration happen in a good way?
Goals, you know, having a joint goal, something to achieve, something to aim for. You know, in terms of teamwork and that cooperation, really in terms of how people are empowered is really key around that as well, so that they do have that, you know, they're motivated by themselves. There are those intrinsic sort of motivators in place where they have a purpose, you know, and if you can give teams a purpose, then that really helps, you know, for them cooperate, work together. And I think also within that, it's just that element of trust, you know, around actually good teamwork. And, you know, with the collaboration piece, that is really built on trust. And moving away from the whole siloed protection, kind of we protect our bit over here, which is IT, or we protect our bit over here, like finance or HR. And it's about, you know, how you build trust between those teams by having those sort of shared goals that everyone kind of get behind and move forward.
That's interesting. So shared goals and trust. But what happens when things don't go to plan? I mean, if there is a lack of trust, does that mean that there starts to be a little bit of finger pointing as well? Or how do you make sure that the collaboration also happens when things don't go smoothly?
Yeah, I think so. Kind of one of the practical things we talk about a lot when talking about ESM is the ownership. So where does that ownership sit? So I am a big believer in something like a service management office, you know, taking out the responsibility of delivering ESM from one of the current teams. So it might start in IT, which is often, you know, the kind of starting point is it'll be, oh, we can do this tool or we can use it across other teams. But actually, by taking that out of the responsibility of those, let's call them silos in terms of how we represent them, and putting that into a central function, I think just helps kind of bridge that gap. And then it's not felt like a, you know, pointing finger at IT or HR, whoever those business support teams are. It's just led from that group outside of those. So it's kind of more, again, it just creates more of a collaborative environment for people to work in. And, you know, there's just that responsibility then is collective. And I think that service management office should really be led by or reporting to, you know, board member. So it's thinking about COO would be a, you know, kind of our preferred choice, because it's all about operations, you know, and how it works. Often might be a CFO as well, just because the way organizations obviously, you know, normally represent and how they kind of report into to finance. But having that sort of COO leadership and buy-in supported by a function that's not part of their business support teams, it just really helps get through those tricky periods and avoid the finger pointing between teams that you want to work together.
And if somebody would, for example, think that, okay, we have a few people in the company that would be ready for this, are there any signs that they could be looking out for to understand if an enterprise is ready? Are there other signs that they could be looking out for to understand, is this something that we could be ready for and therefore we could also pursue?
Sometimes it's easier to talk about some of the things that will get in the way, so kind of some of the kind of actually, you know, starting at actually some of these things might need to be addressed. And some of the kind of red flags for us would be things like, you know, resistance to change. Is there that sort of lack of accountability, or, you know, sort of low employee morale or sort of high attrition rates within there? Those are the things that for us need to be addressed. Then how the organization goes about doing that. And then we would start to look for some of those indicators. You know, I'm a big fan of measuring and reporting. I think it's, you know, it really helps you understand where you are and where you're going and actually, are we getting there? So I think if nothing else to start with, then it is really just about how do we even measure where we currently are? You know, so any kind of from a first point practical tip for us is always, okay, where are we? How do we measure this? And I don't mean, you know, once the ticket's resolved, what score do I get? It's not that kind of, you know, it's more about the employee experience and satisfaction. How do we think, you know, what are our sort of promoters, who's detracting from what we want to achieve and things like that. So I think starting off by measuring, understanding what your baseline score is, and then having that plan in place to then slowly build it up over time, around those three key areas for me, like I said, collaboration, how do we address those and things like that.
In an organization where the measuring and reporting is the first step, do you see that it's more important to have the practices in place where that data is actually getting actively looked at or is the result that's being reported more important? Do you see what I mean? Is the practice or the actual number what would drive ESM readiness or ESM progression?
For me, it would be thinking about the number in terms of not necessarily how you capture it, but actually, you know, it can be measured in a few different ways. It can be, you know, really detailed, very complex measurement, or it can be a much higher level around perception, feeling, kind of quite subjective, but actually being able to kind of do that sort of pulse point type measurement around an organization in terms of where they are and where they think the problems are. It can be quite light touch, but at least it gives you somewhere to start. So for me, it's really more about what is the feeling and what's the kind of gut feel and the number rather than the actual process about how you capture it and keep it very controlled from a data point of view.
Sometimes engineering-minded people within IT can see things related to feeling and perception and that subjective point of view as something that is unreliable, while they would much rather just rely on the things that they can control. And do you see any sort of challenges there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, managing technical teams and engineers is always quite a fun challenge when it comes to things like experience. One of the key areas that we look at are sort of behaviors across the kind of, you know, if you take sort of like a CMMI type index in terms of, you know, where are you in terms of that level 1 to 5. So really when we're thinking about, you know, actually from a maturity around like user experience. So if we were to kind of measure how they are, when we look at an organization, would we think about if we see, for example, heavy use of email for basic questions and support, right? You know, in terms of actually how they engage with people. You know, that's really low level maturity. And then as we go through, we really want to see sort of more support channels coming in, ideally getting to that point of I have one single place to go for everything. And we kind of look for those kind of milestone markers around behaviors and things that we would expect to see. Even things like, you know, if I submit a request to someone via email, do I even know how long it's going to take to get an answer? I guess what I'm trying to get there from an engineering point of view and thinking about technical people is some of the things can be subjective, but you can still put a framework around that that can give scores. So at the end of the day, you can still kind of put a score to it that people go, ah, okay, I can see that we're at level one and how do we get to 1.5 or 2 over time? But the behaviors and things we're looking for will still be quite subjective, but we can put that framework around it so that it does have kind of strict measurements and things in place, if that makes sense.
Okay. Now that's interesting because the behavioral part, we had one Danish customer who was using the type of support profiles that we collect through Happy Signals, where people are either doers or prioritizers or triers are supported. And they have different levels of confidence in their technical skills, and they have different levels of personal preference to solve issues or preference for somebody else solving their issues. And one of the things that they did with their agents is that they have all the agents go through personality tests at the beginning of their working experience. And they repeat that every couple of years so that they understand themselves first, so that they understand that they are different than the people that they're serving, just to have that sort of understanding that my thinking may not be the thinking that the person I'm trying to service.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's... Yeah, no, but that is a really good point. And I guess just thinking about why I kind of got drawn to ESM, just kind of going back to your first question a little bit around in terms of, you know, sort of my personality traits around being a sort of an enthusiast and a people person. So anything that's kind of new ideas or kind of being creative and thinking about how we can do things, I'm naturally drawn to. And then obviously with the people element, again, it just kind of all feels quite natural to talk about. But then I do have to be aware of, if I am talking to maybe like an analyst or a driver, they will want to hear a different message and kind of how you tailor that to suit them, definitely. And so you do have to be aware of all those different types of persona. So definitely self-awareness and self-reflection to understand you is also really important. Yeah, so it's quite interesting that company was doing that. I haven't seen many people do that for their service desk agents, actually. That's really good.
Yeah, and I think... it is one pretty unique even in our customer base. And do you analyze an organization based on, do you ask people in the service organization to take any kind of personality tests or behavioral profiling tests so that you would get a better understanding of who you are dealing with, or is that something that you just do through observation?
So we normally do a small piece of persona work. So we will talk to the organization about the different types of personas in terms of what their support needs are ultimately, and kind of preferred communication methods and stuff like that. The bit that we don't normally get through to is that next level around, are they not comfortable doing it themselves? Do they want someone to do it for them, and kind of that next level down? But definitely personas, I think, are so important to kind of get at least some kind of understanding around the different personas within an organization. I think where most people draw the line, or where most people stop, is they do it based on role. So they're sort of role personas rather than personality personas. And there's a big difference. And I think most organizations do the role persona in terms of, I am an engineer, I need this. But engineers will have different personal personas, right? So it's not one size fits all just because they do a particular role. And I think a lot of organizations maybe just stop at that role part rather than doing the personal part.
So when you go into organizations and help them think about their enterprise service management practices, what's the most common challenges that you face? Sort of one thing that you would wish that, been doing this for years, why is this still a challenge? Are there any sort of things that very common stumbling blocks to start on this journey?
Yes, it's often what the motivation is. So is the organizational motivation seen as a cost-saving opportunity, as opposed to an enhancements around their whole service offering? So I think, there may or may not be cost savings through doing ESM, but that shouldn't be the driver. And I think the moment they start on that foot of thinking it's just the driver is that around that financial, then you actually lose the benefit, because part of doing ESM for me is also then around growing our people, our current teams, etc., getting them involved more, doing more things, rather than just reducing the teams. And I think sometimes people come at it from a cost-cutting exercise rather than a how do we organizationally evolve into a different type of organization.
Has that changed over the last few years? Is there more readiness for actually looking at the enhancement and not the cost?
Yeah, I think so. And I think given how things are now, everyone's work patterns are completely blown out of the water, right, compared to sort of 3 or 4 years ago. So I think we just need to be far more aware of how people are working and how we can collaborate, just because most of our, a large majority of sort of knowledge worker type workforce are remote or working from home. So, things need to evolve, and therefore the employee experience is different to what it was 3 or 4 years ago, where everyone may have been in the office. And things like processes and how we work together, companies have had to evolve over the last 3 or 4 years because, if they weren't collaborative before, it became very apparent during sort of lockdowns and things like that. So companies have had to shift, and therefore they've then had to think about how we measure things differently, definitely. And that has been, and I think that's why we're starting to see, again, ESM and experience kind of come back on the table and on the agenda in the last sort of couple of years again, really kind of start to pick up again, I think.
Who drives this change? I mean, is this something that is pushed by from bottom up, or is this something that's coming top down? Is there the service providers and consumers of those services? So who do you see is driving the momentum in this field?
I think there are a few. I mean, there's, suppliers are driving it. So I think ITSM tool suppliers are driving it, obviously. There's definitely something in it for there. So you've got one angle about it coming from the market and sort of supply. And then there should be a top-down desire, particularly at the moment where, it's a really tough kind of macroeconomic climate. Organizations are, having lots of challenges at the moment, and ESM can help with some of those challenges in terms of operational efficiency, in terms of how they work. So for me, that should be on the radar of sort of senior leaders in an organization to, when looking at how they can streamline or just do things differently. Or you get people like me who are quite annoying, and then they're always saying we should be doing these things and coming along, when I'm part of an organization when I was there saying, oh, we should try this. And yeah, so I think it's coming from all areas at the moment. I think the suppliers are definitely doing their part in kind of raising ESM. They have their own motivators, obviously. I think maybe there's not enough in the middle, sort of pushing up to the COO, or maybe setting that vision downwards as well, sort of saying, hey, these things are possible, because I haven't seen many organizations that do it very well yet, enterprise service management. So I think there are, you know, there's not a wealth of user cases and case studies and stories out there that are really able to demonstrate where it's, you know, been really, really effective.
Is it better to start in a, have something simple, or is it better to sort of start deep in one area and then start deploying? Is there, do you see any sort of benefits or challenges or preferences on how it should be done to actually get started and be able to prove the value so that the push becomes stronger internally?
Yeah, I definitely like to do a little in each. So, you know, small bits across everybody. Ideally, things that might have something in common. So if there is a way of a process or some business activity that maybe involves three or four lines of service, that even if you only do one thing, you just join up those four lines of service on that one activity to then start to demonstrate actually the value just doing that for one thing can add. So it's not about going deep for all of them. It's about doing, maybe finding something across a few lines of service that kind of really help illustrate how ESM could work. And it just kind of helps illustrate and put that in people's minds. I think where we've done that, people then start to see what the advantages are, and then people then start coming to you. And that's where the bottom-up part kicks in normally, is once someone sees something's worked quite well in their area, then they start to think about how the other things they do and the other interactions they have with other lines of service would benefit from the same approach. But that's only really achievable, I think, by doing a little bit across a few at a time so that they can all... And also, I think it really just helps with the whole role on a journey together by not just being... you know, one team doing it quite deeply in isolation, by actually having three or four lines of service at the same time doing something and engaging on something together, straight away you kind of start that teamwork, that collaboration, right from the outset.
Sort of sounds like when you need to plant the seed, you need to get a chance to plant the seed so that then people can start imagining themselves what this could be like. So it's not... It becomes an intrinsic motivator. And this is something you spoke about on the podcast with Matt Barron on the almost a year ago now, about this self-fulfilling prophecy when people have the knowledge and they have the purpose. So do you want to speak a little bit about that? Because it seems like it might be relevant to this sort of multi-service collaboration as well.
I think a lot of it comes down to purpose. And I also think a lot of that comes down to, you know, the new environment that we're all working in, where maybe people have evaluated the work they were doing, you know, how they were, what they were doing and things like that. And I think those motivators have changed for people a little bit over the last sort of few years. And people do want, you know, they want a purpose. And I think also where people are maybe working a little bit more isolated than they were before, having a reason for them to then re-engage with not only their colleagues or their, you know, their main team, but then also with other areas of the department where there is that kind of shared collective you know, purpose and goal. I think that can be a huge motivator for people at the moment when they are potentially isolated, and it helps bring teams together. It helps create a more uniform kind of way of working and organization. You know, just open up those communication channels, you know, I think so important for people at the moment. And yeah, and I think just having that sense of purpose, you know, that really helps people get engaged and kind of just really enjoy the work that they're doing. And yeah, I think it's so key to the enterprise service management piece, any piece really, but, you know, in the context of ESM, I think it's, yeah, key.
You set this up perfectly for a little curveball question. What are the events? Can you go back to some events that have become that thing that motivates your purpose to continue? I mean, you've been doing this for years. What keeps you motivated? Do you have any
not
sort
that
of
many
stories?
Years. I'm not that. well, I think, you know, I think one of the I think, like I said, I'm a bit of an enthusiast, right? So, and also I have an art background. So by nature, I'm kind of quite, you know, creative and always trying to think of new ideas. So I generally don't try not to dwell on where things haven't worked. So it's kind of keep trying to drive it forward. And I think where we had real success, and I'll just pick on, you know, one particular example was at where we first started doing enterprise service management at the construction, at my construction company where I was working before. We decided to tackle HR as the first one. And there was a gatekeeper, for want of a better word, within HR, and it's, you know, these are my things, this is how I work, you'll never change me, kind of thing. And actually it was because of what happened with COVID, that where she used to manage the work because she had everyone around her, suddenly she didn't have everyone around her and couldn't manage the work because she had such tight control over it. And then it was only through doing ESM and talking about how we can help manage the work and have visibility and all of this kind of stuff around, you know, the work and her team and what's happening, that then suddenly it was, oh, right, okay, wow. And then from there on, my tools consultant was working for, and it was literally like every day there'd be a new thing coming. Oh, can we do this? I've thought of this now. Would we be able to do that? And it was almost like I couldn't pass her in the corridor without another idea kind of surfacing. And, you know, it's those kind of little stories and things that you remember that actually when it's done right, you can really change someone's opinion on how they work. And actually for her, it was also she didn't realize how much stress she was putting on herself by the old way of working. And then it kind of, yeah, when she saw that, it was like, I can do so much more. I can do these different things that she wanted to do, but had kind of been stuck because of just the way she used to work. So it's little success stories like that. You know, again, it's not about implementing a tool or anything. It was about that personal change where suddenly, you know, she was able to do, she just changed the way she worked. And just like I said, we couldn't stop her coming forward with ideas at that point. And it was kind of, yeah, a massive backlog just for them. But that was good. That was good.
And was she then instrumental in getting other people on board?
Yes, because then she saw, well, oh, I need to engage with this line of service for me to help do my work. How do we get them involved? You know, and then suddenly it's like, so it wasn't just me trying to reach out to people. There was, you know, other people then talking to other lines of service to say, it'd be really good if you could work with us, like, for example, our fleet department, so organising cars, employee cars, etc. Yeah, those two then needed to hook up to make sure the process was automated or could work. So then she was like, we need to get them on, and she'd help me influence and kind of talk to the right stakeholders to get them on board. So I think once you kind of, I think it's one of those things that once you get going, it almost just becomes, well, you don't stop, because where do you stop at that point? So there's always something, there's always an improvement, there's always another team, always a new request or whatever it might be to just keep building and innovating.
And how much of trial and error is involved in this process? Because, I mean, not every single idea that gets implemented is going to move the needle. So what role does patience have in sort of just believing the process?
Yeah, I think there's patience, but flexible as well, right? So I think it's, you know, I've got really good examples of where we've worked with a team and it's like over-engineered the solution. You know, and it's like, well, you do the process, can do this, this, and this, and this, and this. And then you build it and you realize actually instead of 30 steps, you could do it in 5. And then you have to, so then it is that whole being flexible and not kind of being set in stone. But then, you know, you do have to back that up with, well, let's, you know, we've got to test it now. We've got to work it through. Like you said, be patient. The improvements will come. And I think that's where the measuring thing is really key as well, because if you don't have some kind of measurement, see if you're moving the dial and know whether you are, it's really hard to stay motivated, you know? So I think having that measurement in place and using that as a motivator, even if it goes down, it like, well, what did we get wrong? What do we need to adjust? But if it's going up, then it's like, well, let's do more of this. How do we keep building on it? And I think, so I just keep coming back to, you know, measuring and understanding where you are. You know, and that can be a really good motivator, or it should be a motivator.
So that sounds a little bit like you need to have a definition of what good looks like, because otherwise it's going to be based on opinions, and that's...
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's where, you know, for things like, you know, sort of service management in general, we consider all the administrative tasks at the moment. You know, actually, can we reduce the administrative overhead in terms of work and effort? You know, what does that look like? Can we reduce that by 20%, by 30%? You know, and those can become some of your motivators and kind of indicators as well. You know, and you know, things like predictability of outcomes. You know, how predictable are they? If they're predictable, then it means that actually we've got a really good process, there's less variation. Whereas an immature kind of way of working is it doesn't matter who you speak to, you'll get a different response, potentially a different outcome. So there are lots of those different indicators that I think we can look for as you kind of go through that maturity around ESM.
Okay. The over-engineering piece sounds quite familiar as well. I've seen that quite often. And I like this one sentence that I think it was Mark Smalley who in a community event said that there are things that work in practice, but no way they work in theory. And when you think about that, it's sort of like the other way around, like, you know, it works in the theory, but not in practice. But there are things that in the maybe this environment where many organizations and teams think that we're special, even if their needs are very, very similar from team to another. And there are those things that are work in practice, but there's no way that on paper when they're written out. And maybe is that something that might drive the over-engineering, that like somebody thinks that we're special, we need to do all these different things to make it perfect from the get-go.
Yeah, and it's funny you say that we're special, because the number of times we may have approached a team and one of the first things will be, oh, but we work very differently to how you do things over there. It will never work for us. And then when you get into it, it's kind of like, it's basically the same thing, no matter what. But that is so often the first response in terms of pushback to us is, well, I don't know if that'll work here, because we're quite unique in how we work. We're quite special. And it doesn't take long to then actually kind of break that down. But yeah, that's definitely something we're met with a lot. Around that. And also, like I said, I do like that idea from Mark. Actually, I've read his book around XLAs, and but that idea of actually I like that turning on its head to the usual, actually. Yeah,
the world is, as we've seen the last few years, incredibly unpredictable. What does that mean for service management, and how organizations could be sure to be as well prepared as possible for uncertainty?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, because there's, you know, economic volatility, you know, geographical volatility, and then also just from a technology point of view in terms of the way things are evolving very quickly and what AI might do within the service management space. And I think, you know, one of the key things for us when talking to clients around this in particular, you know, I think having those processes, those robust ways of working, but also, again, for me, it comes down to how do you protect an organization when things are difficult? And really, it all comes down to the values of that company. You know, can the way we work be just an embodiment of those values and that culture? I think the moment a culture is forced, it will soon crumble under pressure. So I think really for me, it's about making sure that culture is actually embedded properly. And it is kind of, you know, it's like, you know, the stick of rock analogy, you break it and you can kind of read through the culture. And I think unless those things are in place, organization will always struggle as things come along and upset it. So that's for me really where I think focusing on that cultural piece, and is it really embedded at the core of an organization? If you get that bit right, you're going to be far more resilient to anything that comes along, you know, and it's just making sure that, you know, and that might be the service culture, whatever your organization is, having that in place will really just provide you that level of resilience, I think.
Having a culture that is really embedded. I once heard this sentence that culture is what happens when the boss is not in the room, which in a way, like I sort of speak to that as well. And are there any tips that, if we wrap up this podcast now, are there any tips that you could provide how people interested in creating that sort of resilient culture, what are the things that they could do on a small scale just to make sure that that kind of culture can start thriving and start growing within an organization?
Yeah, I think That is a really good question to ask at the end to kind of keep me on my toes. I think, you know, a lot of this will come down to, I mean, it even starts as early as recruitment, right? You know, are we recruiting the right people with the right attitude and bringing that culture and able to grow a culture, you know, through the right recruitment, the right hiring. And again, that, you know, but even that will be driven by, are our recruitment teams, are they aligned to our culture? Do they really understand us and things like that? So it really needs to be visible, I think, in everything you do. I think every, you know, your objectives, you know, when you're talking about whatever those objectives might be, there needs to be a line through to see how your objectives relate to your culture and what kind of organization you are. I think the moment there's a disconnect between what we're saying, you know, what we say our culture is this, but actually you're measuring a bunch of things over here and your objectives that contradict your values, then you're never going to be able to sustain that culture. And so I think there needs to be that constant reflection. You know, it takes a level of maturity from leadership and management to make sure that they are not just paying lip service to a culture and that it is actually embedded in the objectives and the way they approach work. And that just takes constant monitoring and discipline to make sure that it maintains. And holding people to account where it's not met. And I think there's the whole idea around a social contract in terms of what our expectations are from people. And when those expectations aren't met, then, you know, and around that would be from a sort of cultural point of view, is if people aren't, you know, being actively engaging in teamwork, or they're not cooperative, or they collab, you know, they aren't those things. And we need to be really clear on what our expectations are, and when those expectations aren't met, what that means, you know, how we deal with it. And that takes strong leadership and discipline from everybody to make sure that that is embedded.
That's really good, because in the beginning of the recording, you spoke about having representation on a board level. And when it comes to the values that a company has, I remember this one example from a construction company, renovation company in Finland, where they really showed that the ethical rules that they had set for the company were something that they were willing to stand by, even when it would cost them something. And it was the one of the leadership level that actually blew the whistle on somebody in the sales function that had used questionable tactics to close deals. And they called it out and they made it go away, even if it cost the company enormous amounts of money. But it was just that, like, we stand by our values even when it costs us something. And for that to happen, it really needs to have that representation on a high level, on the board level, where things actually are being dictated, what good looks like and what are the things that we stand by and when do we sort of flex.
No, and I think that's, you know, you'll see that from organizations. I saw something from Costco the other day on, I still call it Twitter. I know it's X, but I still call it Twitter. There was, you know, an announcement from them just around, you know, kind of them as a strong management team, their position on unionization within their organization in America. But actually theirs was a, we understand that actually this is our failure here because we haven't represented you well enough. And it was that, you know, bold leadership to make sure that actually the culture that they stood by, you know, they need to live up to that themselves as a board and be visible in doing that. And I thought that was just a really good example then from a, you know, a global organization like Costco actually going, do you know what, we haven't quite met our own standards around leadership here for the right culture, and we need to do something about it. And that's a difficult position for people to take, I think, sometimes, and it just takes really strong leadership to do it. But it's those things that really just make sure a culture sticks, and that people come back to you as well. You know, customers come back to you as well if you, you know, demonstrate these things culturally, even if, like you said, it might be at a loss to them in some way. But, you know, people come back to that, and they will keep coming back to you if you get that right.
So wrapping this up, we know that, really start understanding now, I think, based on this conversation, how important that cultural fit is, because it's not individuals working in individual functions that will make service management really flourish and provide the impact that it can do. But it is really about that collaboration, which comes from culture, which is driven by values, and which requires trust and actually standing by those values even when things go wrong. Well, Thank you very much. And if people would want to talk to you and understand a little bit, read more about your thinking and follow you, what are the best ways to get in touch with you or to follow your work?
Yeah, I mean, LinkedIn, you know, it's the most obvious place. I'm on LinkedIn, Darren Rose. And yeah, just reach out to me, message me. Happy to get in touch with people. So yeah, message box is open.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast. And as we say at the end of each episode, stay safe and stay happy.
Thank you, Sakari. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
If you like this episode, giving the podcast a review helps others find this content as well. You can also visit our YouTube channel or our learning center at happysignals.com for some more video content. Join hundreds of like-minded IT professionals who have passed the free IT XM certification course on itxm.academy.